Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a road trip with an antennaed co-pilot and communicating with loved ones on the phone even after they've passed. But first, for the last couple weeks here on the show, I've been exploring the various ways people find friendship and community here in the Valley, a place where it's not always easy to do that. Today, I continue my investigation. I'm sitting in the studio with Dane Barthuli. Dane is a member of a shadowy organization here in the Valley called the Monster Rangers. When he's with his fellow rangers, he's usually in uniform, gray shirt, brown pants, an orange bandana, and a pointed hat. But today, the only evidence of his membership in the Rangers is a small pin on his backpack.
I have an emblem from the Order of Obscurity on my bag.
Can I see it?
Yeah, sure. It's that pin right there.
Oh, wow.
So it's a double-faced crow.
The Order of Obscuria is a subset of the Monster Rangers. According to Ranger lore, the Order is a small but elite group, kind of a special forces unit, first formed in 1911. Like all Rangers, the Order has the uncanny ability to see monsters walking in our midst, beings most people don't even know are there. But the Order doesn't exist to protect us from the monsters. It's actually the opposite.
People see, sometimes they think monsters are these terrifying creatures that, will, mess you up. And but they're misunderstood. They're actually, very kind beings that should be protected.
Given the sensitive nature of their work, members of the Order of Obscuria and all Monster Rangers generally keep a low profile. But every once in a while, Dane says, they recognize each other in the wild.
There was one time that somebody was like, hey, I know. And then they threw up their claw, which is what we do. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize that you knew.
So claw is like you just held up three fingers.
Three fingers. You kind of make like a talon with your hand and you just go caw. And then that's kind of our greeting to one another.
Legend has it that the history of the Monster Rangers dates back to the early 1900s. Many of the stories about them are just that. But one of the earliest confirmed monster sightings was in 2005 in the pages of a book called Caught Creatures. The book contains a series of illustrations and haikus about monsters like the squinch, a mustachioed fish, Ms. Dausch, who resembles a bat in a pink dress with sheep's horns, and Rishi, a feisty little beast with sharp teeth who loves corn dogs. The pictures and the haikus are by this guy.
I'm Daniel Davis. What you're seeing here are, I've started design miniatures in the Monster Rangers universe. So I've been making these buildings that are set in the Southwest of 1913, which is kind of the sweet spot for the Monster Rangers, because we started it, wink, wink, in 1903. Well, that's when they started and we discovered it. And then
I visited Daniel at his house in Peoria, where practically every surface is covered in paint, pens, and other art-making supplies.
And then this is our kitchen / workshop. So around the corner here is our laser. It's ridiculous, I know, but it's kind of where we could have a laser.
This is a laser cutter?
Yeah.
Daniel lives and works here with his wife, Donna.
This is my Skull Ranger uniform. So Skull Rangers speak to the dead. It's one of the branches of the Monster Rangers.
So the Skull
it's
Rangers
fun.
Get to wear black. So that's their specialty, is they can be a little bit more goth on the outside.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Daniel and Donna met in Spokane, Washington. Daniel was early in his career as a graphic designer, and he walked into an art supply store where Donna was working.
When I took him over to show him the pens and our eyes locked, it was like my heart skipped a beat, and I knew I was going to marry him. I just knew it.
In 2004, they moved to Peoria. Daniel had a job working in a print shop, and Donna was a teacher. Neither of them was doing exactly what they wanted to do. Donna wished she was making art, and Daniel was reluctantly designing logos for clients. Between jobs, he spent countless hours doodling these little cartoon monsters. As often as they could, he and Donna would drive to California to go to comics conventions. They would set up a booth and sell merchandise featuring Daniel's characters. They weren't really getting anywhere until late one night in 2005, in the car on the way back from San Diego Comic-Con, when Donna had an idea.
She goes, you know, you could make, why don't you make a haiku monster book?
It took Daniel 2 months to finish the drawings and haikus of Squinch, Ms. Dausch, Rishi, and their ilk. At the next convention they went to, someone came up to Daniel and told him the book was the best thing there. So Daniel and Donna started selling prints of his illustrations. They incorporated a company called Steam Crow to sell Daniel's stuff online. And they started dreaming about quitting their day jobs.
We're both working full-time jobs, raising a kid, and doing Steam Crow full-time. Finally got to the point where I was like, we can't do this anymore.
And Donna was a real trooper because we're doing things like getting out of a show in Anaheim at 11 o'clock at night, driving home, getting home at 3 or 4 in the morning, and then she goes back to school the next that day and teaches.
It took 7 more years, but they finally got to the point where they could support themselves by selling prints, pins, and books from the Steam Crow universe. By that point, Daniel had started drawing a comic called Monster Traffic, set in the world of Monstru,
which is the monster world. It's an industrial world much like our own, except everyone lives in their cars. And it's all steam-powered cars, and there's no people. Like, people don't exist. They're all just weird monsters.
From there, Daniel got the idea of Obscuria, a place where the human world and the monster world overlap, and where a mercenary group called the Monsterologists are scheming to capture the harmless and misunderstood monsters.
For me, monsters sort of represent, they're like people, and often people have problems. And for me, it's sort of like I've struggled with mental illness over the years, so they're broken. And so, you know, we have to rehabilitate them just like we do with people.
That's where the Monster Rangers come in. The more story Daniel came up with, the longer the lines got at Steam Crow's convention booths. They started selling Monster Ranger satchels and merit badges.
When we would talk to people at shows, we were like, it's a pretend group. And then one of our rangers looks at both of us and goes, this is not pretend, this is real. And it became real for them because it was a place for them that they felt they belonged and they hadn't found anything else before.
So, Daniel and Donna decided to host a real-life Monster Rangers camping trip. On the way to the campsite, they scrambled to come up with camp activities that would reflect the ever-expanding Monster Rangers mythos Daniel had been developing.
We're like, oh, crap, this has been around since 1903. What are our traditions? So we make up some, like the Caw Claw. We believe, study, and protect monsters. Caw! So,
yeah.
We cut it. So we make that up, we make them take a pledge, and we make up all kinds of other things. We have an opening ceremony. We have a thing called Doomwood Derby, which is our version of Pinewood Derby. We race and crash cars. We have Barter Circle, which is a place where, inspired by goblin markets, we come together and we trade things. But we all exaggerate our wares. We lie about how great they are, what they could possibly be, like a goblin might.
And so that happens. Oh, we have a magic rock ceremony.
So you created a world that people wanted to live in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
The Rangers loved the first camp so much that by the end of it, they were already asking when the next one would be. So Daniel and Donna scheduled another one, and then another. Today, the Monster Rangers are a sprawling community. To join, all you have to do is take the oath to believe, study, and protect our monster friends. From there, you can join specialized units like the Order of Obscuria or the Skull Rangers. You can go on Monster Ranger camping trips where you'll meet people like Dane Barthuli.
If I had to explain what this thing is, it's a great social group to be a part of. And we have a theme that we go with. And so I think that's kind of what it is for me, to be honest.
Since he joined the Monster Rangers over 10 years ago, Dane has recruited his husband and his twin brother. He says it's a way to gather with people who don't want to be boring.
We call ourselves odd. So we're not, we're odd people. The normal people are not odd is what we call them, or nods. So, but we're more odd is what it is.
That framing, odds versus nods, comes, as you might have guessed, from Daniel.
They're nods and odds. Odds are people like the Rangers or monsterologists who, for whatever reason, maybe they've had an accident, they got hit in the head, they could see monsters. So, but normal people don't see monsters, and that's sort of a parable for we see the world differently. We're quirky, friendly, and, you know, wouldn't it be great if there were monsters among us?
That's the spirit that drew Dane to the Monster Rangers.
I think it kind of reflects on, you know, other things going on, like within our own like world and community, that, you know, people are who they are, and, you know, they are, everyone's different from one another. And sometimes what you think is something that's scary and should be feared shouldn't be, just because you don't understand it.
You might think that a seasoned ranger like Dane has tracked down lots of monsters over the years, but no.
So have you ever seen a monster?
You know, I'm still trying to find them, but I thought I saw one the other day, but it turns out it was just one of my cats just running really quickly in the house.
So you've been doing this for 10 years and counting.
Yeah, close to, yeah.
And you haven't necessarily seen a monster.
You know, even if I don't see a monster, I still believe that they're out there. You know, I will continue to look.
Back in 2020, a woman named Amy Dawson lost her 25-year-old daughter, Emily. In the midst of her grief, she discovered a monument in Japan built by a man named Itaru Sasaki. A small white phone booth on a hill overlooking the Pacific Ocean in the town of Otsuchi. Sasaki, who had suffered a loss of his own several years earlier, called it a wind phone. And the idea was simple. Step into the booth, pick up the receiver, and speak to those you can no longer reach on a regular phone. Dawson fell in love with the idea as a way of communicating with Emily and set up a wind phone of her own. She also set up a website encouraging others to do the same. Here in Phoenix, the idea connected with a member of the congregation at the New Vision Center for Spiritual Living, and that member told Reverend Karen Einhaus about it. Einhaus was moved by the story and resolved to set up a wind phone on the center's campus. Not long after, she got a call from another member of the congregation.
He was at a secondhand store, and he called me and he said, "You're not going to believe what's here, an actual red old telephone booth like they have them in England."
Wow.
And we purchased it right then and there.
Okay.
And that is where our telephone of the wind is housed.
And can you describe where it sits so people can kind of picture it in their minds?
Yeah, yeah. So we are New Vision Center for Spiritual Living, and we are on Tatum between Bell and Union Hills. And on our campus, we have created a piece of meditation garden. And within that piece of meditation garden is a structure that has a telephone in it, and also has an opportunity, has two chairs in it, so people can sit and remain in that space a little while.
And the idea, for people who aren't familiar with it, of the, as you put it, the telephone of the wind, which is a very lyrical way of putting it, is to what exactly?
It is to give individuals an opportunity to talk to someone who has passed away, either to just have a conversation with them or to say a goodbye they were never able to say, or to continue a connection.
And does it have an actual physical phone in it?
Yes. The phone booth has a rotary phone in it. And this telephone is not connected to any network.
Is there anything in the booth that offers guidance or anything, or prompts or anything like that? Mm-hmm. Or is the idea just to go in and have your own experience?
there's a little picture that says you're welcome here to connect with however it feels right for you. Know that you are safe here. And that's all.
Have you spent any time in the booth yourself?
I have. A very important community member who has been a friend for 20 years made his transition last year. And so I often go to the booth. And going there puts me in a very open and vulnerable space that I can just connect with him. One of the things that it was his totem was always the hummingbird. That's actually from him, the hummingbird.
You have a hummingbird pendant, yeah.
Yes. And so when I go there, because it's in our peace and meditation garden, there are often hummingbirds. And what's so wonderful is to just be there and to share with him what's going on.
So may I ask, do I understand that correctly, that you go into the booth, you lift the receiver, and then physically speak into the receiver to tell him about the hummingbirds and whatever else is happening?
Yes. It feels so easy. It feels so easy. I did ask the community to share stories with me. If that's okay, I would like to.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, you share. Have a printout here.
Yes. And so this is from Colleen Garrity, who said, please use my name. And she said, I would love for you to share the story how I connect with my son, Nicholas. And she said, when I first began using the phone, the calls were tender, simple, I miss you messages filled with tears. And over time, those calls have changed. They've become more raw and powerful, filled with anger and questions about why he did what he did. I often find myself stopping here in the middle of the day just to get things off my chest. And she goes on saying that this outlet has been incredibly healing. It has helped me uncover and release emotions I didn't even know I was holding within.
That's very powerful to hear her share that it's not always pleasant feelings that yes. she needs to express
yeah.
when she uses the phone.
Yeah.
So is there any other practice like this
mm-hmm.
that you are aware of that the telephone of the wind reminds you of? Mm-hmm. Or does it seem unique in your experience as a faith leader and spiritual teacher?
I think for me, personally, I use meditation and prayer as a way to connect to what I call the allness of life and the realization that we're all connected. And I find sometimes it's really helpful to have a ritual around it. So going to the telephone booth, opening the door, and picking up the receiver is in some ways like for me going into my prayer chair and sitting down and praying.
Would you be comfortable sharing what do you make of the wind element of mm-hmm. the telephone of the wind?
Yeah.
Because I can't help noticing it's not called like a spirit telephone
yeah.
or, you know, other things we could imagine it being referred to as?
That is such a good question. You know, I have seen the picture of where the original telephone of the wind has been placed in Japan. And there is, it looks like pretty soon the landscape falls away and gives rise to the ocean, right? And so I imagine that there's always wind going on. And I wonder if that is how it came about. And it works. It works because the wind carries away from us whatever we want to release. And
sometimes it brings things back too. Yeah.
I was just going to say it invites us to listen, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. Would you also be comfortable sharing when you go to use it yourself to speak to this person who, as mm-hmm. you said, has passed on? Do you ever hear anything back?
I do. I hear an echo of what we talked about. It's almost a lived memory that comes up. And I believe that those memories are within me and they could come up at any time. And to make space for it and to listen. I think that's what makes it powerful.
Thank you for sharing that. Do people usually come to use the phone by themselves?
I have seen both. We have also had a group of people who come. And I think it was shortly after we had a memorial service at our in our sanctuary and a celebration of life. And then the entire family went out and had like a collective phone call. It almost felt like, you know, when you call somebody who is not close by and it's their birthday and everybody huddles around and says something.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how it was. And mm-hmm. It was just, it normalized talking about grief. And in here, we're not so used to expressing our grief and being with it and sharing it openly. Mm-hmm. And this is an opportunity to do that.
Well, I have been speaking with Reverend Karen Einhaus, who is a reverend at the New Vision Center for Spiritual Living, telling us about the, as she puts it, telephone of the wind, which is there on the campus. Reverend, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
And just a quick addendum to this conversation, the wind phone at the New Vision Center for Spiritual Living is open to anyone who wants to use it, not just members of the congregation. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a real-life event with an unwelcome hitchhiker inspires a Tucson filmmaker. But first, Zuhal Bailey says he'll bring classical music anywhere. And he does it all the time as artistic director of the Mesa Arts Center's Classical Music Inside Out series. The Grammy Award-winning cellist plays in schools, hospitals, retirement homes, and more, and brings a series of world-renowned artists each season to do the same. The goal, he says, is to break down the wall between audience and performer. The last show of their 2026 season is tonight, featuring jazz bassists Edgar Meyer and Christian McBride, who joined us on the show earlier this week. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with Zuhal Bailey more about the series.
Let's begin with a little bit just about you. And I mean, you're Grammy Award-winning cellist. I assume you played this instrument most of your life, and it sounds like dedicated your life to it in some ways. What about it attracted you initially?
The feeling of it.
Yeah.
The feeling of the cello. This is my 50th year playing the cello.
My goodness, yeah.
I started when I was 4.
What is it about classical music in particular that has attracted you, driven you, kept you kind of inspired?
I believe that classical music and what it takes to listen to it, to experience it, gives us the tools to have a better life.
Yeah.
Especially when it's taught to young people. It teaches us how to work well with each other. It teaches on how to problem solve, to take and accept and criticism, but also to have tremendous hope. It also gives us an X factor in expression that, you know, the greatest fear of human beings is what? Well, number two is death. But number one is speaking in public or doing something expressive
right.
in front of your peers or the public. And classical music really gives us kind of the callus. That sounds negative, but I mean like the muscle tone, let's say, to stand up and to continue to stand up as life kind of knocks us around.
Mm-hmm.
The sophistication of classical music also, I think, is one of the things that continues to make it the word classic. It's timeless.
Hmm.
Everyone says the same things about classical music, but classical music's not going away. In fact, quite frankly, I think it's getting even greater.
Yeah. I'm sure you do have calluses, though, from playing the cello.
You
have said, and I'm quoting you here back to yourself, so tell me more about this idea and what you do with classical music Inside Out. You said you want to shock people into the beauty of classical music. Did you feel shocked at some moment in your childhood by it?
Well, sure. Because we are sponges in our younger years, and at some point we kind of close off and do what we've always done. But through music and through education, those young years, if we're brought exposure to a lot of things, that becomes the norm. And so I have always had music and art and expression and an outlet through these kinds of things in my life since age 3 or 4. And so I now expect that to be the case moving forward. And I try to bring that to kids in concerts in their schools, young people's concerts. I actually go to hospitals to play for young people or older people that are in need. No one wants to be in a hospital. But the beauty of music, whether it's even just a distraction, is quite something. I'll take it anywhere. So the shock and awe is, why is that so beautiful and what's he doing?
Right. What's he doing?
What's he doing? Whether he's in a library, a mall, a school, a hospital. And every time, handfuls of people come and ask me, what's going on? Where can I hear you more? Hmm. And where can I see this more? And I invite them to the Mesa Arts Center.
Right. So tell us about the kind of origins of this program. You've been doing it for a very long time now, Classical Music Inside Out, where you do exactly what you're describing there. You bring the music into the community in sort of unprecedented ways, try to break down that wall, as you call it, between the audience and the performance. Where did this come from?
Yeah, well, the Mesa Arts Center is definitely a leader. I think that a lot of presenting organizations in the old days would just put up a poster of someone attractive playing the violin or the piano or this or that and expect people to go.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But the fact is people go to hear their friends. They go to hear something familiar. We look at the internet and we think we know these people. But the fact is hand-to-hand being in person is in my it's the way I live my life. Mm-hmm. So what we did from 2013 on is we built – our audience is to be ready for the concert. Hmm. So the artists come in days before the event, usually on a Thursday night, and they hit every place we can dream up to bring classical music or jazz or crossover or whatever we dream up and make it highly personal. So when those artists walk on stage, those young people know them and are friends with them. Hmm. And there's a cheering of it going on that's so exciting and so not the norm. And that's what my hope was to tear that wall down between the audience and the musicians so both could feel.
So I have to ask about doing this in schools. I have little kids and I'm like imagining what they would say or ask or think about this and seeing it in real life, having really not experienced it in that way before. What do kids say? What's the reaction like?
Well, I tell my personal story is when I was 4 or 5 years old, I would go to a concert and I would be wiggling around
and my mother
would pinch my leg and I'd say, why are you doing that? And she'd say, you have to be very quiet. And I said, why do I have to be quiet? And she said, this is acoustic music. And with acoustic music, the magic is in the soft stuff and you don't want to miss the magic.
That next time.
Yes. And I said, no, I don't want to miss the magic. Yeah. And then I just sit there as quietly as possible. And she said to me many times, you know, can you hear them? And I said, I can. She goes, they can hear you too. Meaning, don't distract.
Does it work?
It did work. And I've gotten up to about 1,200 elementary school kids and gotten them all to be as quiet as deafening silence and play pieces for them and even made them shut their eyes to make them realize the power of using one less sense. I think music is much more than just entertainment. It really is a healthcare system that we're avoiding or we need to expose more of.
Right. I mean, you talked about bringing it to hospitals.
Vibrations,
right?
Frequency. I mean, this is everything from massage therapy to why we're alive.
Really powerful stuff. So. Is there a moment that sticks out to you in a hospital, in a school, and in a nursing home, something like that, that you'll never forget doing this work?
Two quick moments. The reason why I play in hospitals is that my son was born under duress. He was born in 2002. Right after being born, he was taken to the intensive care unit. They wouldn't allow me to touch him. I couldn't get near him, but I could play music for him. So I played my own cello music for him. And I noticed immediately how it affected the doctors, the nurses, the other parents, but most importantly, my own son. And his oxygen went up and his heart rate settled. And I felt like this is truly magic.
Wow.
And he ended up being okay and great. He's 23 now.
Right.
Everything's fine. The second one was that I was playing the other day and a gentleman on the third row began crying in the middle of my first piece. And I stopped and I said, sir, are you okay? And his wife leaned to him and he leaned back and she said, my husband is deaf, but he can hear your cello.
That's amazing.
And he'd been deaf for 25 years.
He could feel it.
He could feel it. And that's what I'm talking about. It has nothing to do with the obvious thing at all in life. It has to do with the subtleties and how you make people feel. And he, whatever was happening, it was shaking something in his body, in his ears, in his head, in his heart, that made him react and start crying.
Give me goosebumps. All right. That is Zuhal Bailey, Artistic Director of the Classical Music Inside Out series at the Mesa Arts Center, joining us, a Grammy-winning cellist as well. Thank you so much, Zuhal, for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Great pleasure.
And we are listening now to Zuhal Bailey performing Bach's Prelude No. 1 in G major. The Classical Music Inside Out series... The Classical Music Inside Out series, last show of the season, is tonight at the Mesa Arts Center. And they just announced their next season, which will feature Appalachian fiddlers Mark and Mary O'Connor, as well as organist Paul Jacobs, jazz piano legend Fred Hirsch, and more. Find out more on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. And you're listening to the show. Good morning. You're listening to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. A Tucson-based filmmaker and actor is out with her directorial debut, and it tells the true story of a road trip she took with an unusual hitchhiker. Claire McNulty's film is called Roach Trip, and as you may have guessed from the title, it's about a cockroach that found itself in her car on a drive from L.A. back to Tucson. It'll be showing at the Vero Beach Film Festival this week, as well as at film festivals in Milwaukee and Calgary later this month. My co-host Mark Brody spoke with McNulty earlier and asked about the inspiration for the movie.
I drove to a gas station that seemed a little dirty, and I picked up a cockroach as a hitchhiker there. It crawled up my leg without me knowing it. And the movie is the story of what happens next, essentially. It's the story of me and this cockroach in the car together and in a remote part of the world on I-10 between Los Angeles and Tucson and all of the magical things that can happen there.
What was your first reaction when you, I assume you felt something on your leg, maybe you didn't quite know what it was. Like, what went through your mind when you realized what it actually was?
Absolute horror.
Yeah.
Abject terror. It was also nighttime, so I didn't know what to do. I think confusion. I think panic, anxiety. You know, and also there probably was somewhere deep inside me some brief idea that wow, this feels cinematic.
So even in the midst of what must have been a terrifying experience, the light bulb was going off. This could be something.
Honestly, yes, because I was actually in the midst of writing a feature, my first feature, and I was already in a creative, you know, storytelling mindset. So I wouldn't be surprised. It may not have happened right when I discovered that there was an enormous cockroach with me in the car. But it happened pretty shortly thereafter, I think.
And just to be clear, like, it sounds like you did not try to get rid of this cockroach. It almost to the contrary, like at a certain point, you kind of decided like, OK, this guy's coming along for the ride.
Yeah. In reality, I did try many times to extricate the cockroach from my car, pulling off of the highway and searching for it, but it was really cunning and it hid itself every time. So not to give too much away, but, you know, I sort of came up with, you know, a plan basically that would keep it in one place. And you're right. Ultimately, I brought it along as a passenger.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of picturing you like kind of a castaway situation, like where you're Tom Hanks and the cockroach is Wilson here. And like, you're just sort of talking to it as if it was a real person.
It's a very apt comparison. People who know me well know that I have a lot of feelings about non-human animals and their cognitive abilities and their ability to communicate, or our understanding of what communication means. I have the capacity to have richer relationships with creatures that cannot talk to me.
because of how I
perceive them.
Yeah. Well, so once you got kind of over the ick factor and realized that this cockroach was going to be part of your drive back to Arizona, how do you think that having it there with you in the car changed your trip, changed your drive?
It got me out of my head. I was on the tail end of a breakup at the time. Mm. And so the movie is very emotional, of course. You know, every movie ends up being very emotional and about, you know, an emotional experience. So I was in a very emotional place, and having this companion made the road trip, it turned it into a bit of a processing session, turned it into a bit of a therapy session, but also sort of an opportunity for performance. There is something that happens when you vocalize, you know, your feelings, your thoughts, whether or not it's with another person, or even if it's just with yourself, that can change your emotional state, can help you process, you know, difficult things. And so it made the trip, for one thing, extremely memorable, but also really helpful, illuminating both my own emotional state and helping to integrate some experiences that I'd had over the last couple of months.
It's interesting. I mean, so again, to sort of quote another scene from a movie, like when you got back to Tucson, was this like a When Harry Met Sally situation where like you each kind of said your goodbyes and went your separate ways? Like what was the parting like after what sounded like a fairly intense several hours in the car together?
In the real life story, the parting, we said goodbye to each other. I took it had crawled into a bag of food, and I pulled it out and I tossed him under a bush in my front yard, and that was it. And I never saw them again.
Wow.
I did actually make a promise to them. I made a promise to them in the car that if they stopped bothering me, if they promised not to crawl on my body, that I would set them free without incident.
That seems like a fair deal.
I think so. And it worked, you know?
Yeah. So what was it like filming this story? Because I understand you had both live cockroaches and a puppet cockroach. And, you know, for a lot of people, like, cockroaches are not insects that you would voluntarily choose to be around. And yet, you know, you kind of surrounded yourself with them.
I did. Well, to be fair, I did not surround myself with them. I directed one or two as a performer.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's a very, very different, you know, interacting with one cockroach is very different than interacting with a lot of cockroaches.
Sure.
But I will say that, you know, we had a cockroach wrangler on set named Jules, and we also had a representative from the Humane Society on set to make sure that we were, you know, appropriately treating them well. And there was an environmental circumstance, which is that it was very, very cold. And it never occurred to me that cockroaches can't function in the cold. Mm. So we worked with two different cockroaches, one of them which had a leash and the other which did not. Neither of them were as crawly as I wanted them to be, because it was simply too cold and the wind was quite strong. So it turned into a circumstance where I was really in charge of the well-being of these animals in a circumstance in which they were incredibly vulnerable. And so my relationship to cockroaches has subsequently changed because I've had this experience where I was like in charge of the well-being of one or two of them.
All right. Well, that is Claire McNulty, a filmmaker and actor living in Tucson. Her directorial debut is called Roach Trip. Claire, thanks so much. It was great to talk to you. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. As some of the Bob Dylan fans listening may be aware, Arizona plays a central role in Dylan mythology. Legend has it that one night in 1978, in a hotel room in Tucson, Dylan was feeling down and out, heartbroken over the collapse of his marriage, and exhausted from being on tour. And in that moment, as the story goes, Dylan had a vision of Jesus, which prompted him to dedicate his life to praising God with his music. That phase ended a few years later, but for a few years, Dylan's music took an explicitly evangelical turn, and he released three records in the late 70s and early 80s that are often referred to as his gospel trilogy. Writer and musician Jason Woodbury has long been fascinated by this particular chapter of Dylan lore and wrote a piece about it on his Substack, Range and Basin. Last year, I spoke with Woodbury more about why he finds this story compelling.
As far as I can tell, you can't really source this story to anything else. It doesn't seem like it, maybe factually it happened. I don't want to accuse Clinton of completely making it up. He very well might have heard it, you know, from a secondhand source. Whether or not this this sort of, let's say, extraordinary paranormal kind of thing happened, Bob Dylan does experience a dramatic conversion in 1978. He really does make a huge shift in his artistic presentation and songwriting.
What's compelling to you about that in terms of the lore of Dylan? Like, what do you like about the idea of Dylan in this moment having this supposed epiphany?
Dylan has always been a master craftsperson of persona. He's always been excellent at creating this air of a sort of aloof, unknowable figure. So I like the idea of a sort of weak and broken Bob Dylan.
It's humanizing.
Honestly. Well, it's humanizing, yeah. And it's deeply, we've all been there, you know,
sure,
on some level or another. So I like that about it. And it's satisfying in this way that that feels, I don't know, maybe a little deeper than just your average rock and roll urban legend.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I loved about the piece you wrote about this is you also you linked to this, I guess they're sort of in Bob Dylan mythology, they're referred to as sermons, these like long kind of rambling talks that he would give from the stage during this period. I mean, I guess he's always done that. But in this particular period, he was given to these meandering ruminations on the themes of the Bible.
Yeah.
I read the Bible a lot, you know. I mean, it's just what it just happens I do.
And one of the things I thought was really fascinating about it is there's one actually where he talks about performing at a college in Arizona.
We were playing about 4 months ago someplace. It was at a college campus. I forget exactly where. It was Arizona, I think it was someplace. Is that where it was?
And what's fascinating to me about it is he's standing there and he's talking about, like, you know, on college campuses, they got these, they talk about ideas, you know, they got professors and stuff.
You know, it's like they have a higher learning people there. They teach them different, like, philosophies. And so people, they study all these different philosophies.
He's talking like somebody who's never been to a college campus or heard of a college class.
Right.
Which, like, is obviously not true. Like,
yeah,
this is somebody who makes, like, you know, references to philosophers in his lyrics. Like, he mm-hmm. obviously knows about these things. And yet it's believable in that moment that he believes himself to be have sort of a beginner's mind about these things in the midst of this religiosity that he was experiencing.
Yeah. Seeing him at the Willie Nelson's Outlaw Festival a couple weeks ago here, I don't think Dylan said, you know, a single word to the audience beyond, I think, introducing the band. It goes even further. He was, like, obscured by a lamp on his piano. So you couldn't even really fully tell that Bob was up there, you know? So he's kind of this silent figure who's obscured and hidden. When you look at the gospel trilogy, he's out in the open in a way that is very different than what we generally associate with Bob.
For all those who have eyes and all those who have ears, it is only he who can reduce me to tears.
I think about how humanizing it is and how when you're fresh with new convert energy, it's kind of totalizing. It's all you want to talk about. It's all you can focus on. And so, again, you see even the great master Bob Dylan himself, you know, just doing this all too human thing.
For me, there's a connection between that sense of authenticity and what was happening and this bigger idea that you're writing about in this piece that I really love, which you refer to as ecstatic truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a concept that I borrowed wholesale from the great Werner Herzog, who is a filmmaker and a writer. Ecstatic truth means that it feels true on some deep level that goes beyond our rationality.
Yeah, something about the idea that this would have happened to Bob Dylan in this hotel room makes this person, who obviously exists, but there are so many things about him that are hard to understand or make sense of, viewed through the lens of that incident, all of a sudden he comes into greater focus.
Yeah. What it's getting at, what it's pointing to, what it somehow illustrates, even in its potential falsity or whatever, is something that is real, does make sense. Art's where the ambiguities, it's where the facts don't, they're not the only thing that matter.
Totally. I mean, I'm also thinking in this moment, I hadn't thought about this until you just said that, about an explanation I often hear for why people love the Grateful Dead so much. And that explanation is that it's not about the fact that they always got to some apotheosis in their jams, because often they failed to get there.
Yeah.
But it was the persistent sense that they might, that there might be this moment of ecstasy that was going to be achieved not just by the musicians on the stage, but by them in communion with the 50,000 people in the middle of a field who had traveled from hundreds of miles to see them. The possibility of transcendent experience. There's an ecstatic truthiness to that.
I mean, it's true. The jams do sometimes meander and never get where they are, quote unquote, going, you know, or where you think that they should go.
Yeah. Sounds a lot like the lives we all live.
But it's like the lives we live. And it's like the it's like when people say, you know, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. If the possibility of failure is in the room, that means that the possibility of some thing that's even beyond success, yes, is also in the room.
Well, and in your piece, I think you talk about the fact that Dylan has, in his live performances and on his records, almost never played any of his songs the same way twice.
And for a certain kind of listener, you're going to be frustrated when you go to see Dylan and you don't realize that he's playing It's All Over Now, Baby Blue until the second verse, you know,
right,
because he's doing it in such a sort of twisted and mangled version of it. And
there is
so,
no truth to
it's
what
not,
the song itself is.
The truth of the song is what's revealed each time you're playing that song. I think of Dylan's songs as a great repositories of incredible and profound truths. And you kind of have to be the one to excavate it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a truth that you and the artist are kind of finding together.
And I think maybe that's why this notion is fascinating to us. As the listener, you are not incidental to the brilliance. You actually are part of it. You have to be part of it in order for it to really, truly work. And so that notion that we create the truth together, I think that's real.
Well, I've been talking with Jason Woodbury, who wrote about Bob Dylan, his alleged moment of transcendence and enlightenment in a Tucson hotel room, and many other things on his Substack, Range and Basin. Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always an awesome time hanging out and talking with you.
Well, thank you for listening to the show on this Thursday. This thing happens on the show sometimes that I love, where one of the guests says this phrase that kind of sums up like the whole episode. And for me, that happened today when Zool Bailey said, "Don't miss the magic." Words to Live By. We hope you will join us again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. right here on the show. For Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman. Talk to you then. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.